Welcome back to the Brexit Brits Abroad podcast. I'm Dr. Michala Benson, a reader in sociology at Goldsmiths University of London and the research lead for a UK and a Changing Europe funded project that's all about what Brexit means for UK citizens who've made their homes and lives in the EU27. In today's episode, we return to a familiar theme, and that's the theme of challenging stereotypes and changing the conversation. And once again, we're talking expats. After a few months of trying to get our schedules to coincide, I was really pleased to have the opportunity to bring Sarah Kuntz into the studio to talk around that age-old question of who is an expat, with a little twist. Sarah was passing through London because she had the final examination for her PhD, which she'd undertaken at UCL in the geography department. And I'm really pleased to let you know that a few days after we recorded this episode, Sarah passed her PhD, so she's now Dr. Sarah Kuntz. I'd come across Sarah a few years previously when she was quite early on in the research for her doctorate. And the final doctorate is entitled Following the Expatriate, the Post-Colonial Politics of a Migration Category. And in this work, she's really interrogating how the idea of the expatriate is produced, as much as how the lived experience of expatriate life is produced in different types of settings. Her PhD covers a series of case studies, which include an expatriate club in Nairobi and also the Expatriate Archive in The Hague. And you'll hear more about that as the episode unfolds. What the episode really shows quite visibly is the dynamics of the categories and labels that people use to describe populations that move, whether those be migrants, whether they be expatriates, and the work that those do to produce particular types of experience, positive or negative. So it was important in this episode to open up further the idea of the expatriate to some kind of critical discussion. I also thought that it would be quite nice to bring in Chantal Lewis, who works with me on the project, and you'll remember that she's been doing some fascinating research with British people of colour who live in the EU27, and also been helping me out with looking closely at how UK citizens who live abroad are represented in UK Parliament. I started by asking Sarah why she thought it was important to open up the idea of the expatriate to critical discussion.
So when I started working on this kind of topic quite a number of years ago for my master's thesis, I don't think I knew the term expatriate. Because I'm originally from Germany, it's not necessarily a term we use. So it quite struck me as an interesting term that has quite a long history. And for me, it was really interesting to see how some migrants, or people that I would see as migrants, or by all definitions were migrants, would be titled expatriate and kind of resist the term migration or the term migrant, right? So I became interested in the distinction between those categories and the way those categories are used to differentiate between different forms of mobility and migration. And that really was the kind of sparked my interest, I guess, in the topic as such. And then, yeah.
Why do you think that that's important? Because that distinction is quite powerful in some ways. What do you think it does?
Well, so that's something I kind of examine in my PhD. So there's a long answer.
That's fine.
So I think it does a lot and it does different things. So I don't think there's one particular thing it does. I think there's different ways that this distinction has worked in particular situations. But if you look at the kind of contemporary discussion around migration, which is obviously quite heated and become quite central to kind of society and how society works, migrant is often a negatively connoted word, right? It's often associated with kind of people that are coming to the global north from the global south. It is a class term. It's often a racialized term. It can be a gender term. And so I think that to some extent, people don't like being called migrant, because it has those negative connotations. And it kind of, to some extent, takes maybe legitimacy away from your movement or from your being in place, right?
So or from your right to be there.
Exactly, from your right to be there and your right to participate on equal grounds, right, to some extent.
So why do you think you hadn't heard of the term expat?
That's an interesting one. I think that expat is an Anglophone term, first of all. And I think it ties into a couple of very particular histories related to the British Empire and also the US American empire, if you want to call it that. So if you look at the history of the term expatriate and trace it back in the kind of US context, and Green has written a really, really nice paper on that, actually. Expatriation used to, and still means in legal terms, used to mean giving up your citizenship, right? So expatriates were British, mainly British sailors that wanted to become American, and that's around up to 200 years ago. And the British didn't want to let them go, basically. So those were times when in Europe, European countries still restricted emigration, not immigration, right? So expatriation was first, or the U.S. Expatriation Act, I'm not sure about the date, I think it was 1886 or something, first stipulated expatriation as a natural right inherent to all people. So you were allowed to give up your citizenship, right? Later on, expatriate became a negatively connoted word, kind of associated with the lost generation in mid-war France or early century France. And those were seen to be American citizens that were, to some extent, disloyal. Bohemians living abroad, kind of.
Exiles.
Exiles, yeah, exactly. People that didn't contribute to the US or didn't, you know, value the American dream, whatever, you know.
That's really fascinating because, of course, yeah. You can see the resonance of those ideas, that idea of betrayal,
yeah.
The idea of not being loyal to your country, the idea of being a traitor, that is still very much associated with those with some of those negative connotations of expatriate, particularly, and I know this is a transferal over to the British case, but particularly in how those British citizens are denoted in respect to Brexit. So in the kind of conversations that people have been having, being told, you are a traitor, you know, you don't live in your country anymore.
Yeah.
Contra, I think, I mean, you've been looking at the case of Harry Schindler.
And Harry Schindler being the acceptable expatriate that has been in the military, and he's lived his life outside of the UK for such a long time, but still he gave his life to our military service, and that's seen as an acceptable expat.
Yeah. I mean, of course, there's that stereotype of the expat kind of living a nice life somewhere in the sun, you know, drinking gin and tonics on a shaded veranda somewhere. People that don't really take the responsibility that comes with being a citizen, I guess. So I think that's one of the powerful stereotypes also in the late kind of colonial period, post-colonial period in the British context.
Yeah.
Did you look at Karen's research on British...
I
think she really captures that well, how people can be imagined as kind of like these exiles that you're...
And what I like about Karen's work a lot is that she gets at the class element quite powerfully, I think, which often expatriates nowadays are assumed to be this kind of middle-upper class, skilled, rich migrants that go abroad temporarily to kind of, you know, develop other countries or, you know, to work for multinational business. But that wasn't always the meaning that term had, and it still isn't the meaning that's given to that term by many people. So I think that her work really speaks to those kind of class distinctions within expatriate communities, if you like.
Yeah, I think that's it's really important because it also speaks to your project, which is to do with demonstrating that it's not a flat grouping. It's not there's nothing particularly homogenous about that group.
Yeah.
What, you know, where it is homogenous is in the representations and within some of the use of the term as a social category, I suppose, for explaining difference. Whereas I think that at the heart of your PhD research, and indeed your MA research, you were trying to do something different. You're looking at that lived experience.
Yeah, so, I mean, we talked about it earlier. So what I really found really useful in my research was that distinction that Gruberger and Cooper made between a category of practice and a category of analysis. And they take the term identity, and you can see how identity is both an analytical term that we use in sociology, for example, but also something that people use in everyday life. So something that has quite different meanings in people's usage, kind of lived experience of that term. And so what I think with regards to the expatriate and what I've been trying to do is not to use the expatriate as an analytical category framing a particular form of migration or particular types of migrant, but looking how that term is used in everyday life in different contexts and what work it does to differentiate between populations, to kind of assign value, to assign legitimacy, to render certain things visible and certain commonalities maybe, and to kind of hide others. And so I haven't even only looked at the expat as a particular person, but also I've looked at an archive and how they use the term expatriate to frame the work they do and the stories they collect. So that's been really fun.
I was going to ask, what does the lived experience of being an expat, what does that term do? What have you found that it does, like, explicitly?
I think it does many different things, and that's one of the things I'm trying to argue. It's not a monolithic term, right? It is always kind of embroiled in power relations and in politics, just because migration is also such a heated topic nowadays, right? And mobility and belonging. If you look at Nairobi, for example, or even Cairo, where I've done research, expatriate helps a lot of people to make sense of their migration when maybe they don't fit that dominant imagination of the migrant. So people that lead quite privileged lives to some extent, at least vis-a-vis the local population or majority local population, and inhabit certain spaces and maybe quite segregated lives, but don't want to necessarily interpret that in a negative way. So we have those terms like parallel society or segregated communities that are all really negative, right, to describe migrant communities or what we assume are migrant communities. And then similar experiences might be described as the expat bubble elsewhere. So it's an interpretation. The term helps to make sense of particular, I don't know, ways of
thinking. That's so interesting, because if you take the example here, like, we're so focused on things like segregated communities and people not assimilating. But if you look at, like, what you just said, the expats abroad, it's like they're allowed to have this bubble. The interpretation is that you're allowed to have this bubble of being in a parallel society.
And obviously that's also contested, right?
Yeah.
From within the bubble and outside the bubble. And to some extent, segregation is always more conceptual than it is practical. People always integrate. And to some extent, immigrants are always already integrated in the place they participate. And that's something I've been trying to show, is that expatriate doesn't necessarily mean that people are segregated, but it means they participate in a particular way.
Right.
And the way they participate is structured by larger power relations and structures, right? So if you go somewhere like Cairo with a particular passport that allows you to kind of move back and forth, and with a lot of, relatively speaking, a lot of economic power, and maybe as kind of a white one person, it structures your experience in that place in a particular way. Right? And then the nationality you hold and the kind of the cultural capital you hold or where you're from will kind of influence who you interact with, and makes it quite easy to adopt certain habits. Especially in places like Cairo, it makes it easy not to walk, but to take a taxi everywhere and to stay inside and behind closed walls and kind of join those expat clubs and move within those circles. No.
So you're really, I mean, through that, when you say you're drawing attention to experience, you're actually drawing attention to how people's experiences in their everyday lives are shaped by all sorts of other forces. So if we were to go back to the question of, you know, why is it an expat enclave, you might start to open up different discussions about places that are deemed appropriate for people to live, but also, you know, particular forms of zoning. You might also be looking at for who can live in a particular space. So you're looking at the things that produce the expat experience, as well as looking at the question of, you know, the expat experience, which could, of course, be considered to be down to just having a few conversations with a few individuals, and could then overly focus on things like the choices that people make,
exactly,
which removes a consideration of those kinds of constraints.
Yeah.
So yeah. I'm really interested in the kind of the parallels between the idea of production of, for example, you talk about the expatriate clubs in your paper on Cairo, and the example of the expatriate archive and how that produces the expat in a particular way. So perhaps maybe start by telling us a little bit about the production of the expatriate club.
Oh, that's interesting.
I mean, earlier you were saying about how one of the important things to remember about these spaces, which we do often associate with expats when we think about expat, when we think about what is an expatriate, it does come to mind the shaded veranda is not necessarily their own shaded veranda. It might be the shaded veranda of the country club or what have you. But you said something really interesting earlier, which was You know, these spaces are not only produced by people that we might think of as expatriates.
Yeah. Okay, let me talk about Nairobi, because that's where my most recent research took place. And so when you look at Nairobi, there's quite an infrastructure of clubs, right? And some of these clubs are old colonial clubs. So you have Muthaiga Country Club, which is quite a famous example, and it also appears in that movie, Out of Africa, which was established as a settler colonial club. Even within the colonial society, there was quite sharp distinctions between the colonial administrators and the settlers. So this used to be a settler colonial club, which has now become a sort of expat club, if you like. But even though it is marketed to some extent as an expat club, it also is a club of local elites. So you have kind of local Kenyan elites and foreign elites intermingling in that space and producing that space and producing the meaning that is given to those mobilities, right? Then you have newer clubs, if you want to call them clubs, such as Internations. I don't know if you're familiar with Internations.
Yeah, I know who Internations are. They exist. They're a kind of a virtual
clubs
that have hubs in different cities.
It's a really interesting setup. Yeah. It's actually a business that was founded by Germans and is headquartered in Germany, and it markets itself as this global expat network, which kind of has chapters in different cities around the world. So you join a global kind of, you join an online platform, much like Facebook in a way. And then there's local chapters in different cities. So in Nairobi, at the time that I did research there, they told me that it was the biggest expat community, Internations community in Africa at the time, in terms of having the most members. But then Internations was a very different kind of club than Muthaiga was. There was no clubhouse. There was no shaded veranda. There was an online platform. And then there was regularly organized events at different kind of upper class venues across the city of Nairobi. But when you look at the social geography of those events that were targeted at expats and kind of marketed as expat events, the social geography really reconfirmed the kind of colonial geography of Nairobi as a city. So those events took place sometimes in the Norfolk Hotel, the old kind of colonial hotel, but just generally in the kind of privileged neighborhoods, right? Where people could then come to by car, it would be in a gated kind of environment, there would be doorman, you know, all of the sort of infrastructure that targets a privileged audience. But then at the same time, at those expat events, you had a lot of Kenyans taking part in those, right? It wasn't just foreigners. And you had local Kenyan doormen that kind of doing the guest listing in a way and deciding who can enter. So you had a lot of different people producing those expat spaces, or what we might call expat spaces, that weren't necessarily only foreigners.
And build on, so what you're saying is that there's, it builds on a much longer history that's already embedded in place, that happens to be a colonial history in this case, and that these new migrants to Kenya, i.e. not the previous colonizers, are occupying those spaces in what looks like very similar ways to begin with, but that probably, as was the case during, you know, during colonization, they're mixing with local elites.
Of course.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And they're kind of co-producing those spaces, right? And the meaning that is given to the term expatriate as well. At the same time, you have many foreigners and quite privileged foreigners in Nairobi that don't want to be expats.
Where were the majority of foreigners from within Nairobi when you did your research?
So Nairobi really is a city of migrants. Nairobi has people from everywhere. Nairobi has a really, really large Somali population, some of which are really, really privileged, right? Businessmen, quite a lot of money. But then Nairobi also has a lot of people working for the UN, for example, because the African headquarters of the UN are in Nairobi. Nairobi is a center for many multinational corporations that have their kind of local regional headquarters there. So you do have a lot of what we might call Western foreigners, right? Mm-hmm. That aren't necessarily all European or American, that maybe have gone to universities in those places and now work for those kind of global corporations and organizations. So migrants, so when we talk about expat spaces, a lot of those foreigners that would frequent those spaces would be people working for international organizations, for the development industry, for kind of multinational corporations, as well as a lot of kind of, you know, interns or people like me, you know, a young researcher, relatively young researcher, with not necessarily that much money, because Nairobi is quite an expensive, you know, place if you go to those places. So I wasn't necessarily, I mean, I entered those spaces partly because of my personal attributes of my nationality. It was easy for me to walk in as a white, one woman, even when I maybe wasn't on the guest list.
Really?
Yeah.
So that's the point at which you realise the kind of the subtle processes through which people are being filtered out of those spaces.
Yeah.
And who's, well, I suppose, who's automatically at permitted entry, exactly, and whose entry is questioned.
And conditional.
Yeah.
Right. So if you look at the definition of the expatriate that Internations as an organization offers, I believe it's something like people that live and work abroad for a kind of temporary period. So it's a really broad definition. But then when you look at who actually takes place in those spaces that are then expat spaces, there's obviously different mechanisms that work together to produce those, you know, groups of people that socialize and mingle in those places. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. So if we were to move to the Expat Archive, and that's the Expat Archive, what's it actually called?
It's called the Expatriate Archive Center, and it's in the Hague. The archive was set up by a group of, they call themselves shell wives or shell ladies. So those were the wives of shell expatriates that kind of moved around the world. And those wives supported their husbands, mainly it was husbands and wives, in their careers working for Shell.
And Shell's the petroleum
Shell, the company, exactly. Company, Royal yeah. Dutch Shell. Yeah. The Royal Dutch Shell group of companies, I think. So it used to be the full title. Not anymore. So when Shell was managing and kind of its multinational business, they relied on a quite elite group of incorporated migrants, if you like, around 4,000 to 5,000 maybe employees that were international staff or regional staff on expatriate contracts that were sent around the globe to kind of manage that business. For the longest time and still now, predominantly these were men. The way that this migration was set up is that they would move with their nuclear family, so their wives and their children. And this was quite a tight community, the Shell world, the Shell community, the Shell family. And Shell wasn't unique in that. So these companies at that time, especially in the 50s, 60s, 70s, had a really, really strong model of organizational socialization. So you had the company men, the organizational men. So people really identified with Shell. You had the Shell men and the Shell wife, right? So the title
and Shell children.
And Shell children, right?
Yeah.
But those women felt, especially in the 90s, things were changing. Feminism, you know, took place. I mean, it has been for a while, but these women realized that their contributions to their business weren't necessarily recognized in the way that they wanted them to be recognized. They'd given their lives. Some of them had sacrificed their own careers. That made, to some extent, they'd made it possible, right? They had created a community. So what they did was they started the Shell Ladies Project, which was collecting stories and anecdotes and poems of those Shell wives and children. And then they published two anthologies on Life on the Move and Life Now in the 1990s. So those kind of anthologies were really targeted at the Shell community itself. And then only
to
later,
change the story about the community.
Exactly, to kind of bring out those
the contributions.
Stories. Yeah, the stories of the women and contributions of the women to the business, right? Which was the older businesses. Imagine as a male business, right? The male pioneer or like the male geologist or whatever, you know. In those foreign places somewhere. Mm. And then only later, so they had all of these original documents left over from those anthologies, and those then became the first collections of that archive. And the archive was first associated with this spousal support group called Outpost, which Shell wives started themselves. So they had their spousal support organization, and then they had an associated archive. And then later, due to different circumstances, the archive became independent and kind of widened its remit beyond the Shell world, if you like, and now became an expatriate archive center.
Interesting.
Yeah. So you have the biggest kind of collection is still loosely kind of related to Shell migrations. And it's a really, really fascinating body of work or body of sources, I should say. It's really interesting. And when you look at the materials in the archive, you really do realize that migration studies as a discipline has been quite partial and really has not for the longest time looked at those privileged mobilities as migration.
So much not spoken about. So many things that we've taken for granted. Like there's whole networks of people that are just not really spoken about.
Yeah.
And I mean, is that a privilege in itself though? That like
extent.
Yeah, that you just get to be this hidden
of course,
network.
I mean, if the debate around migration is negatively connoted and migration is negatively connoted, which isn't only, of course, you know, that's quite simplifying. Not being a migrant or being invisible, invisibility always has certain benefits, right? You're not problematized in the same way. But then, obviously, there's also other sides to that story, I guess. And that's changing. I mean, it's changing with your work and it's changing with like many different people, folks in kind of unconventional, if you like,
things that don't conform to the category of migrants, exactly, or people, yeah, who don't conform, exactly, to the category of migrants,
yeah,
or the category that is migration, for, exactly, example. I've got my scare quotes, yeah, in my thing. No one can really see them.
I live with scare quotes.
But I suppose, I mean, there is something about that, which is, you know, you've just talked about invisibility and the some of the benefits of invisibility, but you're talking about a project that was set up by women who felt that their story had been erased. Mm-hmm. And so that's quite, that comes with a whole another dimension. I mean, it's, I don't know if I've ever told you this, Chantelle, but it's one of the reasons that I went into studying migration is because I'm not a Shell child, mm-hmm, but I was a child of another petroleum company.
Oh, wow.
I probably shouldn't mention. and so very much so, we moved around, yeah, following my father's job, which did on one occasion take us out of the UK. It also took us all around the UK. And it's very, very notable the type of gendered relationships that are expected in those settings. Of course, quite a lot of multinational corporation life has changed significantly, yeah, since the 1990s when my family was going through that. And those contracts, they're not so reliant on those contracts anymore for corporation life, although there are some exceptions to that. But
I think that is really interesting because, and so much that you're talking about really does apply to Shell. And Shell massively restructured its business in the 1990s, actually, because of the decreased willingness of staff to be, yeah, mobile. And one of the big reasons, so there were two main reasons which they identified amongst their staff, which was children. People didn't want to send their children to boarding schools anymore at age 8, you know. And the second was women's expectation to have their own career and not just blindly follow their husbands to some extent, right, and be this kind of supportive role. And these wider societal changes really forced Shell to make some changes to their business setup. So it's not really that Shell was at the vanguard of, reforming the gendered labor market. they really responded to necessity. But it is quite interesting. But when you look at that time in the 90s that the Shell Ladies Project kind of started, they didn't use the terminology of migration at all. That only came in much later, when the archive was already independent. And so these two discourses of expatriation and migration kind of converged. And that the debate that we have now of who's a migrant, who's an expat, is, you know, kind of happened to place much later. But the category expatriate within Shell is also really, really interesting, because for the longest time, the expat was not, the wife moving along was not an expat. The expatriate was a male staff. And
so it's completely tied to the labor market.
Exactly, to that job role. And then you did always, there was always women moving with Shell. There was teachers, female teachers. There was female nurses moving abroad as incorporated migrants for Shell. But they were not titled expatriates. And they were not the managerial elite, right? So the expatriate was a particular category tied to this kind of professional, managerial, male employee. That was always your... almost always, always Euro-American, white, and male, and classed already. Yeah. And then in the 90s, you see those Shell wives kind of appropriating that category as patriots, saying we are expats too, you know? And like our story really does make expat life as well. And then only later did you have other people coming along, or maybe it was them as well, I don't know, being like, actually, you're migrants too, you know? And then framing the story of expatriation within the kind of field of migration, which is then, so the archive then organized a symposium in 2013 where they really then, I think, adopted the terminology of migration. But I can't speak too authoritatively on that. I don't know exactly when that happened.
That's fascinating.
It's really interesting when you see how those categories change.
Yeah, how dynamic the categories are, but dynamic in the way, in the work that people want them to do for them.
Exactly.
And so there's always some kind of social intent behind adopting those particular labels at particular points in time and trying to break them out of the bounds within which they're normally structured.
Yeah.
I suppose that, you know, in kind of drawing to a close a little bit, I suppose a final question might be, you know, you've talked a lot about, well, talked a lot between that ten, about that tension between migrant and expatriate as labels, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But where would you like to see this go in terms of who is a migrant and who is an expat?
I think that what we should be doing predominantly is not trying to categorize people, but looking at specific contexts and specific debates and looking how those categories are used and to what effect. So I don't see for myself or in my PhD, I don't arrive at a conclusion as to who is a migrant, who is an expert, and how are these categories related to each other. But I think what is more fruitful to some extent is to look at how people, whether they be scholars or, you know, people at the pub, how people use those categories and what the results are of their use of those categories. So given the kind of, given the existing definitions out there for both the migrant and the expatriate, you could argue all of it. You could argue that expats are migrants. You could argue that expats are a particular subtype of migrant. You could argue that expats are not migrants. Or you could argue that migrants are subtype of expats, right? It just depends on what definition you use. So I think that more useful than making that sort of claim is kind of studying more how those categories are produced and how those categories are used.
And what damage and harm that they're exactly. doing, as well as what they reveal about power relationships exactly. and social justice and all of exactly. those kinds of things.
Yeah. So what I find interesting is always when someone argues about something about migrants and stuff, and so how do you define that migrant? Because most people don't even think of a particular definition. They just use that kind of catchphrase.
Easy hook. Yeah.
Easy hook, you know.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So I suppose then what you're advocating is a migration scholarship that is attentive to the work that migration and migrant as categories have been doing.
Exactly.
And the work that expatriates and expatriation have been doing, and that thinks critically about what bringing those together might do in really making us understand the broader geopolitics of population movements in
yeah,
the world today.
Thank you. That's a really nice
to summarize.
Yes, that's exactly what I would like us to do. Yeah,
sounds brilliant.
Thank you.
I'm signing up to that.
Yeah, fascinating.
Thank you very much.
Thank
that's
you.
Great.
Thank you so much for inviting me. That was really interesting. Thank you
for listening to the Brexit Brits Abroad podcast. If you've enjoyed what we've been talking about today and want to find out more, check out our website www.brexitbritsabroad.com, or you can follow us on social media via Twitter @BrexpatsEU and on Facebook. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. And I'll speak to you again soon.